Welcome to today's edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In addition to feature reports, I'll bring you a look at regional and national agricultural news. And the show starts with a look at California agricultural news.
Early registration for the 2024 Crop Consultant Conference, hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and Western Region Certified Crop Advisors, is now open. The popular event for certified crop advisors, pest control advisors, grower applicators, and industry professionals is the mainstay for all continuing education needs this year and will take place on September 25th and 26th at the Visalia Convention Center. Visit myaglife.com/events for the early discounted rate of $275 per person, which includes the live conference, a trade show with 70-plus exhibits, first-class dining, entertainment, and a mixer. We'll see you there.
A state bill to boost affordable housing on agricultural land in a Golden State is among the proposals the California Association of Wine Grape Growers plans to shepherd this year. The proposal, Assembly Bill 2746, by Assemblyman Carlos Vallepadea, a Democrat of Stockton, would streamline the construction of affordable housing on agricultural land. Under the bill, affordable housing construction would be used by right without the need for expensive discretionary evaluations such as a public hearing before a planning commission. These discretionary reviews trigger environmental review under the California Environmental Quality Act. Under the bill, construction would have to abide by all local laws. The renters would have to be agricultural workers. However, they would not necessarily have to work for the landowner. AB 2746 was one of the toughest bills Miller says he's worked on. What works in Napa, where there are grower assessments for farm worker housings, or Monterey, may not work in other regions. AB 2746 was one of the toughest bills that Michael Miller, COG Director of Government Relations, has worked on, he said. What works in Napa, where there are grower assessments for farmworker housings, or Monterey, may not work in other regions. State legislation to boost affordable housing in a Golden State has been approved recently. For instance, Governor Gavin Newsom signed Senate Bill 4 into law in October to streamline affordable housing construction on religious properties. COG, which anticipates opposition from local governments, seeks a coalition to support the bill. The California Housing Partnership, which supports a proposal to place a $10 billion affordable housing bond on the November ballot, has not yet endorsed the bill. Past efforts to streamline farmworker housing have been ineffective because the rules require a public agency or a nonprofit organization to operate the units, according to COG. COG's other priority bills include AB 1861, which would extend the Pierce's Disease Control Program within the California Department of Food and Agriculture for research, treatment, and prevention. The existence of the board in charge of the program would be extended from 2026 until 2031. Miller expects no opposition. The bill is also co-sponsored by Wine Institute and Family Winemakers of California and requires CDFA's annual report on Pierce's Disease Control Program to the legislature to be posted online. Another priority bill sponsored by COG would boost the state's efforts in the prevention and management of invasive and destruction species, such as the grape-loving spotted lanternfly. A live spotted lanternfly has yet to be found in California, according to state officials. Still, the insect is now present in 18 states, according to Cindy Cron, North Coast IPM advisor at UC Agriculture and Natural Resources. Experts at CDFA and the U.S. Department of Agriculture said the arrival of the spotted lanternfly in California is only a matter of time. COG is also supporting AB 2827, which is legislation that would require CDFA to allocate funds, if available, towards a prevention program in conjunction with other relevant state agencies, according to the text of the bill. The bill was co-sponsored with California Citrus Mutual and was proposed as the state's citrus industry confronts a surge in exotic fruit flies and quarantines in San Bernardino, Riverside, and Ventura counties, as well as in South Sacramento and San Jose. Other co-sponsors include the California Agricultural Commissioners and Sealers Association and Redlands Chamber of Commerce. Another priority bill is Senate Bill 1135 by Senator Monique Limon, a Democrat from Santa Barbara, and it would create a tax credit program for ranchers, landowners, and growers who use compost, biochar, and other natural farm practices to maximize carbon sequestration. Additionally, COG is also urging legislatures to support a bill to amend farmworkers' overtime law. The bill would increase regular hours from 8 to 9 hours a day. The supply of lemons is improving out of California's District 1. It's peaking on larger fruit, with smaller fruit being still somewhat limited. However, District 2 crops are going to provide a lot more supply in the next few weeks heading into the Easter holiday, according to Joshua Schwartz of Four Seasons Produce Incorporated. And all that's making for an abundant supply of lemons throughout March and heading into April. It's a slightly different picture from this time last year, when a crop had a better array of sizes. This year's sizing is largely due to all the rain that California had during the bloom season. California is supplying a majority of lemons in the U.S. right now, with District 1 providing about 80% of supply and District 2 providing the remainder. However, there's also some volume from Spain and on the East Coast. As for demand, it's been consistent for lemons. He says they only see demand increase here as the change of season begins and the warmer weather approaches. With a tight supply of smaller sizes, there's also more promotions on larger sizes, with them being more abundant. This means that choice fruit pricing right now is very promotable, while fancy fruit is getting promotable. It's not quite like the choice is. On a smaller fruit, the market is high and will remain high, even with District 2 coming in, according to Schwartz. Palm Wonderful, the worldwide leader of California-grown pomegranates and number one pomegranate juice in North America, has announced the addition of pomegranate fiber to its growing specialty ingredients lineup. The pomegranate fiber, which is upcycled from Palm Wonderful pomegranate husks after juicing, is a grass fiber dense powder that can be used in a variety of food applications, including crackers, sauces, dressings, baked goods, and plant-based food. Pomegranate fiber is made under Palm Wonderful's growing specialty ingredients division, which provides raw ingredients to suppliers across the food and beverage industry. Pomegranate fiber has numerous culinary benefits. It can help draw out flavor and color, and in baked goods, the powder enhances browning, which ultimately reduces cook times. It has soluble and soluble fiber plus antioxidant goodness and polyphenols. The addition of the pomegranate fiber comes on the heels of Palm XL's upcycled certification, further underscoring Palm Wonderful's commitment to sustainability and product innovation. Meridian Growers of Madera has promoted Tyler Zion to Director of Sales. In this new capacity, he is responsible for all sales for the company. Zion was hired in February of 2023 as the sales representative. Since coming on board, he has progressed quickly and proven his ability to adapt and grow in his industry knowledge, according to company information. He will oversee the sales of almonds, pistachios, and pecans that Meridian grows and sells worldwide, and the company is eager for him to strengthen his market base and continue its mission to be the bridge between growers and users of dried fruit and nuts. Data for February from the Southern California ports once again confirmed the continuing strength in U.S. trade and continues the positive trends in container volumes. Executives for both the Port of Los Angeles and the Port of Long Beach highlighted the strong start to the year for the ports after the weak 2023 volumes and a positive outlook based on the U.S. economy. The Port of Long Beach cited cooling inflation, rising consumer confidence, and an ongoing effort to recapture market share boosted cargo shipments moving from the port in February. Similarly, the Port of Los Angeles pointed to the economy being led by job growth, while noting the market confidence is strong and a cargo is flowing efficiently through the gateway. February was the seventh month of consecutive year-over-year growth for the Port of Los Angeles, while total volume was up 60% over a very soft February of 2023. The port also highlights that the volume is exceeding the five-year running average by 15%. They noted that volumes are back to pre-pandemic rates. The growth, they noted, is coming in all categories for the Port of Los Angeles, with a 64% increase in ports and a 61% increase in exports. It was also the ninth consecutive month of year-over-year increases in exports, with the port saying that the growth was being led by volumes in agricultural products, recycled goods, and plastics. They acknowledged that the last February was softer than normal, in large part due to an earlier date for the Lunar New Year, but that shippers were also last year rerouting cargo away from Southern California ports due to the protracted labor negotiations with dock workers. The Port of Long Beach saw similar strengths in February, with an overall 24% increase in volumes, driven by a nearly 30% increase in import container volumes. Exports, however, lagged down 21% at Long Beach.
Last year, with the abnormal amount of precipitation the state received, there was an increased concern about disease and fungicide use in orchards. When more fungicide applications than usual need to be made, the risk of creating fungicide resistance increases. Thus, it's important to rotate products and use different modes of action. This year has also been wet. Here's what Corteva's Bryce Borges has to say about preventing resistance.
The first thing that I usually kind of reference is what What is the reason for using a fungicide? And we're using a fungicide to control a disease. So whenever we use that fungicide, we want it to be as efficacious as possible. So we select the fungicide that will be effective and control the disease and keep the disease from causing too much of an issue and losing production. So that's kind of the basic that I always go back to. And obviously, going from one mode of action from a fungicide to another is an extremely important process in doing this successfully.
The lack of rotating modes of action is the key driver for resistance. Resistance in general, regardless of an herbicide, fungicide, pesticide, etc., should keep pest control advisors up at night, Borges said.
It's the tools that we have to battle the pests that we're going against. And typically, we've seen it in various cases where something we are used to using and it's being effective, and then one day it stops being effective. Things like maybe picking lower rates might lead to resistance. Things like targeting the wrong pest with the wrong fungicide. So treating for a disease that's not covered by the fungicide you're using. And repeated use leads to resistance. So it's something that education is extremely important, and knowing what fungicide you are using versus what disease, and knowing what the labeled rates are, it's something all factors have to be considered in order for it to be effective.
Another thing to keep in mind is what neighboring orchards are doing with their fungicide applications, as well as what diseases those orchards may have.
Knowing what diseases are present, in your given area, and making timely treatments for those diseases will help the overall pressure get reduced. So, if you are treating for disease in your orchard or your vineyard and your neighbor is not, that becomes an issue later. And then just knowing, what products might they be using and what products are you using, and making sure that you're making the right choices.
You're listening to My Ag Life. I'm Taylor Jahlstrom.
My Ag Life is brought to you by ICL Growing Solutions, a leading global fertilizer manufacturer and exclusive miner of polyhalite, marketed as polysulfate. Learn more about ICL's cutting-edge crop nutrition solutions at icl-growingsolutions.us.
Dairy prices have been low for some time, but there may be reasons for optimism during the second half of 2024. Lucas Fries, the senior dairy analyst for Rabo AgriFinance, says the industry needs to get through the next few months first.
We've got to get through kind of the spring flush period over the next few months. Of course, the peak milk producing months of the year for the U.S. So even though supply down versus prior year, we'll still have ample milk flows in the coming months.
Looking ahead to the second half of the year, there are a lot of factors that will influence dairy prices.
A lot of variables kind of come into play into that second half of the year. It's possible that we could have summer heat kind of knock milk production back a little bit. The economy continues to kind of chug along here in the U.S. We've avoided what we thought was the worst case scenario of entering a recession so far, and we're optimistic about the health of the consumer into the back half of the year. In addition, maybe looking at exports to Mexico, that has been a pretty bright spot as well, even though I mentioned exports. Some struggling a little bit. Mexico has been a really good market for us.
While things are tough now, they can rebound rather quickly.
There's a variety of things that could come together to really make the back half of this year, the second half of this year, kind of a period to look forward to, if you will, for farmers in the coming months. It was just 18 months ago in mid-2022 that we saw some of those record high milk prices. It's easy to get discouraged in times like this when we've kind of got challenges from all angles. But looking ahead, the U.S. is very well positioned, especially when considering other key dairy exporting places around the world, places like the European Union, New Zealand. Over the long term, we see milk production being challenged in those regions, and we still see growth in the U.S. over the long term.
Lucas Fries of Rabo AgriFinance. A group of Senate Republicans are demanding the Biden administration take action to increase agricultural exports. The group of 19 senators penned a letter to U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, urging them to increase U.S. agricultural exports and improve the competitiveness of U.S. products abroad. The letter says the current sharp decline in U.S. agricultural exports is directly attributable to and exacerbated by an unambitious U.S. trade strategy that is failing to meaningfully expand market access or reduce tariff and non-tariff barriers to trade. The lawmakers say diminishing access to foreign agricultural markets for U.S. industries creates significant economic headwinds and jeopardizes the livelihoods of more than 1 million American workers, farmers, and ranchers. For the 2023 marketing year, nearly 70 million acres of major crops like corn, soybeans, and wheat were planted to meet the demands of foreign customers. Bio-based products, already a big part of agriculture, will likely play an ever bigger role in the future as more oil-based items turn into those made from plants. USDA's Rural Business Cooperative Service head Betsy Dirksen-Longeren says bio-based products will be a huge part of agriculture in the very near future.
It's going to start with the farmers, and that's where the money's going to go if we have anything to say about it. You know, I think that what we're going to see in 5 years is the biopreferred product label everywhere. It's going to be an industry standard. People are going to be looking for it.
From new fertilizers to aviation fuel, farmers will play a role. Alex Minotti is vice president of government affairs at LanzaJet.
Commercial producer of alcohol to jet sustainable aviation fuel. And as was mentioned, we just in January opened that world's first commercial plant down in Soperton, Georgia, 10 million gallons per year of ethanol to both jet fuel and diesel.
Just a fraction of a potential 36 billion gallon industry if Treasury and also the Environmental Protection Agency modernized ethanol emissions standards. Small-sized farmers and specialty crop producers now have an updated online resource available to find crop insurance agents who provide both whole farm revenue protection and micro-farm policies. USA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
Over the past 2 years, USDA's Risk Management Agency has been educating small-sized farmers and specialty crop producers on two specific crop insurance products tailored to their operation, whole farm revenue protection and micro-farm policies. The latest efforts to connect eligible growers with local crop insurance agents offering these products involves an information resource update.
We've updated that agent locator site with a new searchable directory.
Found at www.rma.usda.gov. RMA Administrator Marcia Bunger says the new update is based on input by specialty crop growers and small farmers to improve crop insurance coverage and those offering such.
To help those individuals looking for a whole farm, micro farm specialty agent, somebody that has been selling, is experienced, knowledgeable about this particular product.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Two Senate Agriculture Committee members are questioning the Department of Agriculture's telework policy. Republicans John Boozman of Arkansas and Joni Ernst of Iowa request USDA's Inspector General to build upon its oversight of the federal agency's telework abuse and expand its investigation into the department's footprint and workforce. In a letter, Boozman and Ernst called for an enhanced investigation after USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack was questioned during a Senate Agriculture Committee hearing last month. The committee focused on the department's supervisor's revelation to the committee that the agency's headquarters resemble a ghost town, to which a secretary claimed that his employees and managers are in the D.C. office a majority of the week. The letter states Secretary Vilsack's apparent misapprehension regarding the telework posture of his workforce underlines the importance of comprehensive reviews, audits, and evaluations of the USDA telework, locality pay, and space utilization policies. The letter requests a response by this Wednesday.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.